What we're gonna do right here is go back. Way back. What we're gonna do right here is go back. Way back. Back into time.
Back to the old school.
Hello and welcome to the Retro Asylum. Foggy. Today we're gonna do another top 10. It's going to be the top 10 Commodore Amiga games from the year 1988. Now, I chose 1988 as the year to pick some Amiga games out because that was the year I first got an Amiga. And a lot of the first games that I actually saw for the Amiga are included in this top 10. Now, you've got to remember, I came straight off of Commodore 64 to see this Amiga, and all of these games made my jaw drop. They were brilliant. I consider them still very, very good games. Some of them have aged better than others, but that's just the nature of the beast. That's what happens to retro games, and it's the purpose of these top 10s, in a way, to find the games that have age well and are still relevant and still very playable today. Again, this isn't an official top 10 of any description, it's my own personal top 10. The order that the games are set in, from 10 to 1, aren't necessarily representative of the game's quality or playability or graphics or sound or anything like that. It's just the games that I would tend to pick up and play from this year. I'd be interested to hear some of your memories of some of these games, if you was around at the time or you remember any of them, or if you'd never played them before and decide to look them up yourself. Be interested to know your opinions on these. Hopefully I can inspire some listeners to check these games out or revisit them. They shouldn't be forgotten. They're still very good games, all of these. So without further ado, let's get on with it. Number 10, Manhunter, New York.
Spine-tingling chills, flesh-eating orbs, and creepy cupid arms. Introducing Manhunter, a foreboding science fiction epic created by the authors of the mega-hit The Ancient Art of War. A dark vision of our planet's future, Manhunter evolves around the life of an Orwellian spy in New York City, 2 years after alien invasion and consequent world takeover.
There once was a manhunter from New York who took a wrong turn in a park. He stepped on a mine, should have read the sign. Now he is scattered from dawn to dark.
Our hero is contracted by the newly founded alien dictatorship as a manhunter. His goal? To seek and destroy a ring of human saboteurs and unruly militants hoping to end alien rule. Every step of the way could prove to be your last. Manhunter includes several new innovations to Sierra's acclaimed 3D animated adventure game system, including split-screen animation and advanced windowing effects. What better way to view squished heads, famished baby orbs, and rotting corpses?
This was an early point-and-click adventure game, set in New York, obviously, and it was made by Sierra, or Sierra Online. It was designed by Barry Murray, Dave Murray, and Dee Dee Murray. And it's set in the what would be then futuristic year of 2004, when the Earth has been enslaved by a race of aliens known as the Orbs. Now, the Orbs graphically are represented by big floating eyeballs. That's what the aliens look like, if you'd like. And they've implanted all human beings with tracking devices just to keep an eye on what's going on with humans, which they've enslaved. And they employ some humans as manhunters, which is what you are. And your job is to investigate suspicious human activity in and around New York. Now, without giving too much away about the plot, you can follow various clues and leads around the city, and you discover that the Orbs are up to no good, as you would expect. maybe you should play the game, try it out yourself, or failing that, at least look at it on YouTube. Now, graphically, the game is terrible. It's reminiscent of a very early Commodore 64 game, and we're talking about the Amiga here. So, could be forgiven for thinking that the game is rubbish as soon as you see it. But this is the kind of game that you need to play, rather than just see. When I first got my Amiga, I sent off mail order for a couple of games. This was one of them. I think why the reason I like this game is because I read the instruction manual thoroughly and checked out the screenshots. And it was the anticipation of actually playing the game. You've got to remember, I received this game a good couple of weeks before I actually got my Amiga, so the excitement was building for at least a couple of weeks. When I actually started playing it, I wasn't disappointed. The game oozes atmosphere. But you only get that atmosphere if you actually play the game and try and figure out some of the puzzles yourself. And it's going to be quite difficult to play this game emulated, mainly because I haven't found an ADF file to use on an Amiga emulator that has been hacked in any way, or cracked in any way, I mean. It all asks for copy protection, so you pretty much have to have access to the manual, which gives quite a few clues away as well. The only real way you're really going to play it and get the most out of it, probably, is to actually play it on a real Amiga. You can score this game off of eBay or other auction sites for maybe £10, sometimes £15, sometimes £7, something like that. So between £7 and £15. And the game itself had no live dialogues. Much of the gameplay had to do with tracking individuals with device and unlock new places and addresses. The game had a follow-up released in 1989. Imaginatively titled Manhunter 2, but this time it was in San Francisco, and it continued the story. It was the same game in a different city, and obviously a different plot, but exactly the same gameplay. And I suppose it might be a little bit of a spoiler, but at the end of Manhunter 2, it sort of suggests that there will be a Manhunter 3. Now, bearing in mind this game was made in 1989, there hasn't been a Manhunter 3 yet. Maybe a Kickstarter project or something in the waiting, but as of yet, nothing. It was released on MS-DOS, the Amiga, the Atari ST, the Apple II, and the Tandy 1000. I definitely recommend, if you like a bit of a mystery and are prepared to look past the graphics and the sound and actually look into the gameplay, it's worth getting. If you're a graphics junkie, you won't like it. But definitely one of the good games I do remember playing from 1988, so it's got to go in the top 10, and here it is in number 10. Number 9, Star Wars. This is the arcade conversion of Star Wars, the Death Star battle, where you play the part of Luke Skywalker in the X-Wing, and your mission is to blow up the Death Star. Simple as that. Those of you who played the arcade game will probably know this game, but I'll go over it quickly. It's a vector-based graphics game. You see yourself from inside the cockpit of the X-Wing fighter. In the first level, you have to go around shooting TIE fighters. Second level, you go into the Death Star itself, into one of the trenches, and avoid the guns and walls that are in the trench. And the object of that mission is to send your photon torpedoes into the exhaust pipe of the Death Star, blow that up, and level 2. There is an additional level which involves flying along the surface of the Death Star. That's only from level 2 onwards. Okay, so that's the game. So why did I pick this? Well, when I first saw the Amiga, there was a handful of games really impressed me that my friend had. This was one of them. I remember being really, really, really impressed, because up until that time, I'd seen a lot of arcade conversions onto home systems, and they were okay, some were better than others. This was probably the first accurate conversion to a home system I ever saw. There's very, very little to differentiate it between that and the arcade version. The only thing I could really spot was some of the digitised speech was different. But as for the speed of the game and the actual content of the game and the levels, perfect. Perfectly emulated. Or converted, I should say. This was released in the UK by Domark Software. Originally, I think in the States, it was released by Brodebund Software.
The original arcade game was made by Mike Halley, and the manufacturer was Atari. Of course, the arcade version is the best because it's actually using a vector graphics on a suitable screen. This is as good as you're going to get to a conversion, and even now, it's still one of the best pound-for-pound arcade conversions there is on any system. Certainly one of the first Amiga games I had the pleasure of playing, and holds very special memories for me as someone who was getting very excited about getting an Amiga. So it had to be in the top 10, a very, very good conversion, and I definitely would recommend giving it a go. And this goes in at number 9.
Number 8, Barbarian. Barbarian is a one or two player fighting game. The coder was Richard Lienfelner. Graphics were by Gary Carr and Joe Walker. And the musician was Richard Joseph. Again, it was one of the games that I got with my Amiga as part of a pack-in. And although it doesn't show off what the Amiga can really do graphically, it is a great game, and still I can play it without any problems now and really enjoy it still. Those of you who've got the original this game will recall that was a poster included with it, and that poster featured Wolf from Gladiators and Maria Whittaker, who was a page 3 model at the time. Quite a saucy poster. This isn't to be confused with the game Barbarian released by Psygnosis. The one I'm talking about here is Barbarian by Palace Software. So it's Barbarian the Ultimate Warrior. It was originally released in 1987 on the Commodore 64 by Epic Software, and it was published as Death Sword in the United States. What the game is basically about is you are a sword-wielding barbarian, and you have to brave a series of challenges set by an evil wizard to rescue a princess. Standard fighter game storyline there. It was released on the Acorn Electron as well. Of course, the Amiga, the Amstrad, the Apple II, the Atari ST, the BBC Micro, Commodore 64, the Spectrum. It was released on MS-DOS as well. And the Amiga version graphically isn't a hell of a lot different to some of the 8-bit systems. Maybe a bit of a rush job, but the gameplay has been retained, and that's the main thing as far as I'm concerned anyway. And of course the Amiga, or the 16-bit systems in general, have some digitised speech. As I said, it supports one or two players. Two players is a lot of fun. Some of the moves are really, really cool. There's what I can only describe as a reverse spinning head chop move. I'm sure there's a better way of putting it than that. But ultimately, if you can get that right, you can chop your opponent's head off. That bounces on the floor, and a little green goblin comes and boots it away like a football. The single player story mode, you control a barbarian who is on a quest to defeat an evil wizard called Drax. And there's a princess who's been kidnapped by Drax, who is protected by 8 barbarian warriors, and you've got to basically kill each of these 8 barbarians. And then after that, you face the evil wizard himself, Drax, and you rescue the princess. Quite a simple storyline, but really you're just playing it it's a hack and slash fighting game. You don't really need to have a storyline to enjoy it. As for playing it today, well, you can quite easily play it on emulation. Doesn't take long to get used to the controls. Instantly that spinning headshot move is press the fire button and push the opposite way to what you're facing. Always a good move. The game has, of course, been remade for the PC. If you Google Barbarian Remake for Windows, you'll find it. There's a version, a very good version, that was made, well, completed in 2003. If you would like to buy the game for the Amiga, at least, on an auction site, it will probably set you back between £5 and £15, depending on the condition of the box. Or if you buy the pack-in version, which is usually released in a small plastic box that's very cheap. More often than not, given away free as to make up the numbers in the job lot, for instance. Very playable, even today. Definitely worth checking out. And Barbarian by Palace Software goes in at number 8. Number 7, Zany Golf. Zany Golf by Electronic Arts. The designers are Will Harvey, Ian Goulden, Jim Nickchus and Douglas Fulton. It was released obviously on the Amiga, the Apple, the Atari ST, MS-DOS and the Sega Mega Drive as well. It's a crazy golf game, set in an isometric 3D viewpoint, 1 to 4 players. Most fun actually when playing with your friends, although it still is fun playing it on your own. Quite some good features that you can play it two players, i.e. knock your opponent's ball out of the way, etc, etc, snooker style. Now, why it's called Zany Golf is the holes are zany. It's quite an apt word for the game. I'll just go through some of the holes and what some of the hazards are. Well, the first hole is the windmill hole, which is just what you expect on a crazy golf course, shooting the ball through the windmill. Number two is called the hamburger hole. The hole is covered by a hamburger, which you've got to click your mouse on to get it bouncing. And of course, you hit it in the hole when it's up in the air. Bit weird, but zany. I think you'll agree. The third hole was called walls, and there's four walls that constantly rise and fall back down. And the fourth hole was called the pinball hole, where the level begins the game of pinball, where the player can hit the ball with the flippers after shooting it, drop two targets before opening the hole that you've got to get in. Quite a good take on that. Five was called fans, which is there's fans all across the course that blow your ball all around the place, so you've got to avoid them or try and knock your opponent's ball into them. That's good fun. Level six was a hole called the magic carpet, which is a special magic surface covering most of the course that allows you direct mouse control over the ball. Number seven was called the castle, where a ball has to be shot to enter a castle with a portcullis. Kind of standard crazy golf fair, if you like. Number eight was called the anthill. Course resembles a giant anthill with eight slopes. There's a bumper that bounces your ball around, etc, etc. There's some hazards like that. Number 9 was quite a strange hole called Energy, which is a two-part hole. There's a giant computer, and you have to press two buttons on this computer with your ball. When you've completed this level, it opens up a mystery hole, a bonus level, if you like, which is like a breakout-style game, or Arkanoid. It's you have to hit your ball, knock down loads of bricks to get to the hole. So, rather than just making a crazy golf game, which would have been the easiest thing in the world for these people to do, Electronic Arts to do, and it would have sold in 1988, there wasn't anywhere near as many Amiga games around. So a good crazy golf game would have sold, but they really went to town on this. The graphics are excellent, and they still are all these years later. Kind of Ren and Stimpy style, cartoony graphics. Very crisp, very clean. Animate quite well as well. The main thing lies in the gameplay. You've got to play against one of your friends. That's when you get the most out of it. If you play single player, you just go around on your own doing it, and it's fun, but it's much better with one of your mates. So definitely worth checking out. Play it two players if you can. It's all mouse controlled, so you can play it two players on emulation without having to find a joystick or anything like that. That's Zany Golf, and that goes in at number 7. Number 6,
is Elite. Well, we all know Elite, especially with the new game that's being made for a Kickstarter at the moment. This was, if you like, as far as I was concerned, stage two of the evolution of Elite, in a way. First of all, you had Elite on the 8-bits, but it really did take on another level when it was released on the 16-bits, i.e. the Amiga and the Atari ST. Not only was it a lot smoother, essentially the same game, it has to be said, but a lot smoother graphically. It was excellent. Rather than having wireframe graphics, these graphics were all coloured in, shaded in. The spaceships are actually solid rather than just like coat hangers flying about. It looks brilliant. It was smooth. The cargo status screen had icons rather than just words. The space stations and the planet looked really good. The backdrops were really well animated. The other ships looked brilliant as they were coming towards you. It just moved this game up another level. Now, I'll quickly go hark back to the 8-bit origins of this game. It was developed by David Braben and Ian Bell, originally on the BBC. And any BBC fanboys will always throw that in your face if you ever dare say their computer wasn't very good. You would, to be honest. I mean, it is a groundbreaking game. It was released, obviously, on the BBC Micro, the Acorn Electron, the Apple II, the Amstrad, the Commodore 64, the Spectrum, the MSX, the IBM PC, the Acorn Archimedes, and, of course, the Amiga and Atari ST. The developers say that it was inspired by the film 2001 A Space Odyssey, Star Wars, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and Battlestar Galactica. And you can certainly see some of their influences in the game. Braben also cites the works of Larry Niven, Arthur C. Clarke, Robert L. Forward, Isaac Asimov, Orson Scott as influences for the game. And this game could be regarded as the archetypal space trading game. You couldn't really have a top 10 on the 8-bits or 16-bits without thinking about this at least. It certainly would be in the top 100, without any doubt. You start off at a space station called Lave with 100 credits and a trading ship, your Cobra Mark III, and off you go into the world of space battle and trading. Now, if you have the original of this game, the packaging and marketing of the game also sold the game. There was a book called The Dark World, which is a novella. It tells the story of a young pilot, Alex Ryder, whose father Jason is killed when their merchant ship is attacked by a notorious pirate. It had key cards, it had an elite membership club. It just had lots of little extra bits and pieces that gave a sort of background to the game and the environment you were playing in. This game was named number 12 on the IGN's top 25 games of all time list. So that should tell you something about the actual game itself. Specifically, the Amiga was a little step up with regards to graphics. They looked brilliant, and it did reignite my interest in the game once I had it on the Commodore 64. But to play it on the Amiga a few years afterwards was just reignited my interest in the game. Of course, later on the Amiga, Frontier Elite 2 was released. That maybe will be in a top 10 if I do one for 1993, which is when that was released. So that's Elite by Firebird. That goes in at number 6 of the top 10 Commodore Amiga games for 1988. Number 5, Buggy Boy. Some of you might recall that myself and Matt Denaris spoke at some length about Buggy Boy in the top 10 Amiga driving games that we did on an earlier podcast. It would have probably been ignored by me in this top 10 if we hadn't discussed it that day. It got me playing the game again, and I appreciated it for what it is now as well as what it was then. A fun driving game. And why it's in where it is at number 5 was because it is a very, very good conversion from the arcade again, and that bumps its score up in my head anyway. You control a buggy where you've just got to drive around pre-designed courses, basically just getting as many points as you can by collecting flags or driving under score flags, which obviously as soon as you drive under them you get the score that it says on the flag. Obstacles in the way are white barriers, rocks in the road, trees, things like that, boulders. If you drive over a log, your buggy will fly up in the air. So if you see some obstacles coming up and there's a log there, hit the log, you'll fly over the obstacles. If you drive over a rock, your buggy will flip up onto two wheels and you can get through some tight corners, gaps. There's tunnels, there's rivers, you've got to cross on bridges, various hazards. Probably not doing it a great deal of justice by describing it to you. It's a game that should be picked up and played. Standard driving fare. You'll see your car from slightly behind the actual car itself. Joystick control, high gear, low gear, set flags to pick up. You know, it tells you your certain colours of flags that you need to get, score points by getting them, and a graphical representation of the track on the top left hand corner, as you can see what's coming up. Now, for a game that's in number five, there's not a hell of a lot I can say about it apart from play it and then you'll know what I mean. It's fun and should be treated as such. It's not a serious off-road buggy simulation or a serious racing game. It's just a fun game to pick up and play. So that's Buggy Boy by Elite, and that goes in at number 5. Number 4, Speedball. This game was released by Mirrorsoft. The developers were the Bitmap Brothers. This game did raise the bar of Amiga gaming for that year, I do believe. It's graphically superior to most games of the year. And the sound effects and music were excellent too. It was presented very well. You are a futuristic speedball team, and speedball is basically futuristic rugby, and your job is to score more goals than your opponents. Obviously that involves a certain amount of violence, and by all means necessary you will score your goals. That's the idea behind speedball. You start off, you can pick your team and they're graphically represented by the three captains. You can choose to play in a league or a knockout tournament. And then off you go. The ball will fly up from the ground. You have a basketball-style tip-off. Again, one of these games that can be played by one player against the computer, but much more entertaining playing two players, if you can do it. Expect to pay on auction sites maybe about between £8 and maybe £14-15. Maybe a bit cheaper if you want it unboxed or if the box has got damage, etc. But for a collector's one with the poster that came with it, maybe over a tenner anyway. This game was overshadowed somewhat by the sequel that came out a little while later called Speedball 2 Brutal Deluxe, which is a superior game in every way. But that shouldn't take anything away from this. It came out in 1988 when the landscape of gaming was fairly new for the Amiga, and this is certainly one of the best games of that year, and that's why it's in at number 4. Really think about trying this game, but I know in reality everyone's going to go to Speedball 2 and play that a lot more than this. But without this there wouldn't have been a Speedball 2, so consider that. But since this is the top 10 Amiga games for 1988, and this was a 1988 game and Speedball 2 wasn't, this goes in at number 4. Number 3, Battle Chess. Battle Chess, developed by Interplay, released by Electronic Arts. Yes, it's chess, with a twist, again. The pieces are represented by real characters, i.e. for the pawns, they're kind of small knights. The king and the queen are represented by a king and a queen, as are the bishops and the knights. The castles are quite interesting because they're sort of rock monsters when they spring into life. And when you take one of your opponent's pieces, they will go through a small battle sequence. And the battle sequence is different depending on who's taking who. So there can be a good quite a few combinations of animations where your opponent will get taken in some way. And these animations are quite comical. They can range from simple sword fights to someone getting bashed on the head or stamping on their foot or completely obliterating with a magical spell. I mean, it's a fun chess game, very graphically excellent, excellent atmospheric sound effects as well. Again, one of these games to show off your Amiga, the kind of game that would show a clear difference between 8-bit systems and 16-bit systems. If you didn't want all the razzmatazz and the tomfoolery of animated characters fighting each other, you can opt to play just a normal chess game with 9 levels of play. So alternatively, it is just a box standard chess game, but no one wants to play that. Everyone wants to play it where you can see one of your castles take a knight and smash his rocky fist down onto someone's head. It's enormous fun and still very, very good to watch and play today. I've got this currently loaded onto my GP2X Wiz. It's there if ever I want a quick game of chess. You can obviously pick to have the normal game of chess, but you've also got the option of having a bit of fun as well. Probably, if you mention to many Amiga users Battle Chess, they know the game. It was a fairly early release, but is associated with the Amiga, so it did achieve quite a lot of fame in its time. It was also released for other systems, including the Commodore 64. The only thing Battle Chess did lack is some music, but really, you didn't need music. An excellent chess game, excellent graphics, and enormous fun. And that's why Battle Chess goes in at number 3. Number 2, FA-18 Interceptor. This was the first flight simulator I ever saw on the Amiga, and I was blown away. It was released in 88 by Electronic Arts. The developers were IntelliSoft. The design was Bob Dinnerman and Moses Marr, and the musician for the title music was Dave Warhol. This was a flight simulator in every sense, but it had an arcadey feel to it, mainly because you could have external shots of the interceptor you was controlling, which gave it that sort of afterburner type feel. There was 6 missions, and although that doesn't sound like many missions, they were very involved, and it was really a true sandbox game. You could fly anywhere and interact with your environment as you saw fit. You started off Top Gun style on an aircraft carrier, or you could start off on an airstrip on the island. The first mission was you had to just identify enemy aircraft without firing against them, and that would progress on through dogfights, protecting your aircraft carrier, The final mission was to destroy an enemy submarine that had surfaced, which I didn't manage to do, and I've since seen how to do it on YouTube, but I couldn't manage it at the time. This game has to be played to be appreciated. The graphics, although by today's standards, aren't what you would call excellent. They were brilliant for the time, and it was just little touches where, for instance, this might sound very trivial, but for the time, it was just these little touches that made the game a cut above, and that was your landing gear. Now, if you got an external shot of the plane and you press the key to retract your landing gear rather than just disappear, which you did in pretty much every other flight simulator I've ever played, you'd see the landing gear slowly raise up into the body of the aircraft. They didn't need to animate that. It was just little extra bits and pieces that they did that made the game what it was. It could be accused of being quite easy to play, but maybe that was part of its appeal. It was quite basic, but you felt like you were playing a full-on serious flight simulator, and the battle modes were very well done, and you could really throw the aircraft around and almost feel the G-force, you know. There was another flight simulator released a little while later called Falcon, but really I played this first and I preferred this probably because I played it first and I had the wow moment. By the time Falcon came out in 88, same year, I was used to the Amiga somewhat, and it didn't have as much impact on me. And on top of everything else, F-18 Inceptor is more fun to play. Incidentally, I should just say you're flying around the San Francisco area. That's where your theatre of war is. If you had a 1 meg Amiga, the 512k RAM expansion, the game had extra music and some extra sound effects. But to be honest, if you played it on a box standard 512k Amiga, it's just as good. Really, this is one of the best flight simulators that I can keep going back to, because it's pick up and play. You don't really need to have a massive keyboard in front of you. It's quite arcadey in its feel and a lot of fun. Just give yourself 5 minutes to familiarise yourself with the keys, and I pretty much guarantee you'll be playing this for a good hour before you even think about getting bored with it. And maybe you'd go back for more as well. So that's FA-18 Interceptor by Electronic Arts. And that goes in at number 2. Anyone who had an Amiga would have heard of CinemaWare, one of the best companies that made games for the computer. And if you've heard of CinemaWare, you would have heard of Rocket Ranger, one of the best titles. Now, the people that worked on this game, normally with games, up till now it would have been one or two people working on the game. This has a whole host of programmers, directors, graphic artists, musicians, audio effects, voices. I mean, basically the programmers were Peter Kaminsky and Tom McWilliams, with additional programming by Randy Platt. Chief graphic artist was Jeffrey Hibbers. Original music was done by Bob Lindstrom. Randy Platt, however, was he actually did some of the voices for the game. The inspiration for this game was drawn from the Rocketeer comics of the 1930s and 40s, and it's set in wartime. It was released for the Amiga, MS-DOS, Commodore 64, the Apple II, the Atari ST, and the NES, which I didn't know about. Now, the story goes, you are a scientist, an American scientist, and you're working in your lab one night, and some futuristic artifacts are teleported into your lab. They're from the future, and it's a future where the Nazis have won World War II, and they've enslaved the whole world. The scientist who sent the artifacts did so in the hope that the player could reverse the outcome of the war. What made the Nazis win the war in this game is their use of a mineral named Lunarium, which has the ability to lower IQ of the human race so you could enslave them. And Lunarium is made into bombs and drops from a fleet of Zeppelins flying at higher altitude than anti-aircraft guns. And the incredible thing is that Lunarium is only mineable on the moon, so you need to at least be on the moon to mine it. So that's the background story to the game, which I didn't actually know, funnily enough, until I did the research for this. Now, you as a scientist are also the Rocket Ranger. Now, you've got to fly around the world with your jetpack and your laser pistol to just disrupt the Nazi war effort and their mining of this Lunarium. And you do this by sending spies out all over the world who report back on you to tell you what's going on in a certain country, for instance. One of your spies could send back a report that in Libya there's lots of Nazi activity, and you would then fly out there, deal with the problem, and fly back and refuel and keep doing this sort of thing. During your journeys across, backwards and forwards across the Atlantic, you sometimes would come into contact with enemy aircraft and have to shoot them down. And also from time to time you have to rescue a kidnapped scientist or his daughter, which is the love interest in the game. And in this section of the game you would have to engage in a fist fight with one of the guards, for instance. The ultimate goal of the game is to collect 5 parts of a rocket ship and 500 units of Lunarium to get to the moon and close down all the mines. But it turns out that the Nazis were not the only ones involved in the scheme. Yes, there's aliens in this game, which I didn't know about as well. All these years I've been playing this game and I didn't know half the storyline to it. Now, the original game was, of course, lovely, had a lovely box, and it also had copy protection. To fly to and from a location, the rocket pack must be filled with a very specific amount of fuel. Too much or too little will cause a hero to sort of overshoot and fall short of the target. In other words, game over. You could determine the correct amount of fuel for your starting and finishing destination by using a code wheel that was supplied with the original game. It was quite a good twist on a form of copy protection, but did sort of make you feel more involved in the game rather than cinema-ware just trying to stop you copying their games. What I remember most about this game is the presentation, the box, brilliant artwork. I suggest, if you're interested, certainly look the artwork for the box up. Really captures the spirit of the game. The graphics, of course, with all cinemaware games, were exceptional. The music, as you should be able to hear in the background, was always brilliant in cinemaware games. And this game had speech in it, which, although we're talking 1988 here, speech was still fairly unusual in computer gaming. I never actually completed this game. I don't think I even got close to completing it, but That didn't seem to matter. I have really fond memories of playing this game. It's loads and loads of fun. Quite a technical game, loads of gameplay, and definitely a game to show off your Amiga to someone who, for instance, had a Commodore 64, for instance. Overall, I would say, without any shadow of a doubt, that this was the best game for the Commodore Amiga in 1988, and that's why it deservedly takes its place at number one. That was the top 10 Amiga games for 1988. I hope you've enjoyed it. Again, I must stress, this isn't an official top 10, and you will probably disagree with some of the selections I made, and you'll probably think, why hasn't he included ... game, whatever that would be. Well, if I have missed anything out, then let me know. You can go to the Retro Asylum forum, that's www.retroasylum.com, or find me on Twitter. My name on Twitter is Retro Darren. And if you find me on Twitter as a result of this podcast, then just let me know. It'd be interesting to meet some listeners on Twitter. Quick shout out to everybody on the Retro Asylum forums as well. Thank you for being enthusiastic and keeping the forum going. Also, I'd like to say a quick hello to the Retro Asylum team. That'll be Andy, Glenn, Swainy, Matt, Damien, and Darren, who moderates the forum. If you'd like to suggest the top 10 for me to do from a certain year with a certain system, then by all means suggest it. I can do a bit of research and see how we go. Not sure what the next top 10 is going to be and for what year, but I'm definitely going to do another one. If you're listening to us on iTunes, then please leave an iTunes review. That would be nice. And I'm done now, so thank you for listening. I really hope you've enjoyed it, and I'll catch you on the next podcast I do. Thanks very much.
How would I describe it?
I think it's fantastic.
Awesome. It's going to skyrocket. Only Amiga makes it possible.
Only Amiga makes it possible. Only Amiga makes it happen. Only Amiga makes it possible. Only Amiga makes it happen.
Amiga's got the guts to do things that you can't do on other hardware.
And it does all the work for you. Wow.
State-of-the-art technology at a price that everybody can afford.
The Amiga is the best graphics machine available in the world today.
Only Amiga.
Only Amiga.
Only Amiga.